To follow up on last week's show, when we interviewed anti-nuclear activists, we bring you now Red Eye Co-op Radio's segment entitled The Myth of Green Nuclear Power. This interview comes from Canada, but contains much applicable to nuclear power everywhere. We also thought you might be interested to hear the plans of our neighbor, whose nuclear power plans will certainly affect us over the border.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Canadian nuclear watchdogs had hoped that nuclear energy was on its way out. Ontario Hydro shut down 8 of its nuclear reactors in the 1990s, and without expensive reconstruction, all of the other CANDU reactors would be shut down by 2020. But with global climate change and uncertain oil supplies, governments and communities are looking for alternative energy sources, and the nuclear industry wants to position itself as that alternative. According to the Canada Nuclear Association and the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, nuclear energy is clean, reliable, and affordable. John Bennett is the Senior Policy Advisor of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at the Sierra Club of Canada, and we've reached him at his home now in Ottawa. Good morning, John, and welcome to Red Eye.
Morning.
How much truth is there in the industry's claim that nuclear energy emits no pollutants?
None whatsoever. It, in fact, routinely releases radioactive isotopes in the operation of the plants every single day that they're operating. It's not true that they're absolutely clean. It is true that they don't release carbon dioxide or some of the other pollutants that coal-fired power plants do, but there are lots of questions about the implications of continually releasing tritium and strontium and other radioactive isotopes into the water and into the air around the plants.
And what about the uranium mining itself?
Well, the mines are, you know, traditionally some of the most hazardous places to work in terms of getting cancer. Numerous miners in northern Ontario have died of cancer as a result of working in the uranium mines. The mines also create huge piles of tailings. You know, it's several orders of magnitude of radioactive waste when you're mining uranium per amount of uranium you actually ship. And then once you ship the uranium to be processed or refined, there's also several tons for every ton of refined uranium. There's several tons of tailings that have to be dealt with. So this is not an industry that's clean.
So that's at the beginning of the mining process. There's dirt. You're saying there's radioactive. There are radioactive pollutants regularly released. What about the waste that's created by producing nuclear energy? What hazards does that pose?
Well, this is truly the most critical part. There's about 100,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste stored at the nuclear power plants in Ontario right today. There's no solution to what to do with that. There's talk of maybe one day digging a big hole and putting it in the ground. But we have to protect that material from getting into the environment or from getting into the hands of those who might want to use it to make bombs. And you don't actually have to make a nuclear bomb to make a huge environmental a threat to assist modern society. All you have to do is put a little dynamite in with a supply of high-level waste, and you create a dirty bomb that can spread cancer-causing radioactive material, plutonium and uranium, over a wide area and cause thousands of deaths.
Now, despite what you've said about the dangers and hazards already present with the use of nuclear reactors and nuclear waste, there was a recent report in Ontario called Ontario Power Report, I believe, to expand the nuclear energy industry in Canada. Does that pose an immediate danger? Is the Ontario government seriously planning to rely on the use of more nuclear energy?
Yes, it certainly sounds like Premier McGuinty wants to continue to captain the Titanic. He wants to back up and try another run at that iceberg. In Ontario, every electricity bill has on its final line is called debt repayment. And over $20 billion of debts that were run up through our reliance on nuclear power over the last 30 years.
You say $20
billion? $20 billion has been run up, and we're paying that off. And so if I were to be a power generator and I built a windmill in Ontario and I wanted to sell you electricity, if you bought that wind to electricity from me, you'd have to pay a surcharge on top of that to pay off the old nuke debt. So even though we've got a $20 billion debt and we have a history of tremendous cost overruns in the cost of building these plants, to give you an example, the newest, most modern plant in Ontario is the Darlington plant. In the 1970s, when construction began, the cost of building that plant was going to be $3.5 billion. By the time it was finished and opened in 1992, they'd spent over $13.5 billion on that plant. And then 10 of the reactors went down in the mid-1990s, and they did some repairs to put some of the Pickering reactors up since then. And a project that was supposed to cost $1 billion to fix four reactors cost $1.3 billion to fix the first reactor alone. There are huge costs and huge safety implications of nuclear power, yet we're dealing with ideologues. The people that promote nuclear power in Canada and around the world just believe in it. And no matter how many facts you pile up in front of them, how much debt, how many accidents, how many near misses take place, how many times the plants break down and have to be taken offline, they still look at you and say, oh, no, this is going to be the cheapest, most reliable power. And it's just not true. If Ontario has, even Ontario's greenhouse gas emissions went up because we rely on nuclear power, because when they broke, we had to have very large-scale coal-fired power plants to back them up. And it's really, in Ontario, we're moving backwards. Terms of producing power. We should be designing a system of the future, one that has numerous micro sources of electricity across the province rather than a handful of super large plants. Then we have a much more reliable system. We have a system that's, you know, where if there's any pollution produced, it's produced in the area where the people are using the electricity so that you're not putting off. The thing with the big power plants is we tend to put them off far away from the urban areas where the electricity is needed, and if something goes wrong, people who have very little benefit from those plants will take the brunt of the cost. We need to have a system that's much more advanced and more environmentally benign. And the technology is there, the science and engineering is there. We just have to deal with the vested interests that want to build the plants, because the only money in a nuclear power plant for the people that built it.
Now, you mentioned the vested interest in the ideologues, and they seem to be now in an aggressive mode. Previously, they were very much in a defensive mode. What explains that change?
What happens every 10 years or so is that suddenly the nuclear industry gets kind of depressed, and its latest repair job is run out, so they're looking for new work. So they start to run television ads and start to do public relations talking about how the industry is going to come back. This attempt at a revival is featuring using Patrick Moore as a spokesperson for nuclear power, which is odd because when I used to work for Greenpeace back in the 1970s, he was the one that approved the first anti-nuclear power campaign that I launched in Ontario. So they're bringing this campaign back to try and convince us that that they have something to offer. And, of course, they have lots of money because it's the very large engineering firms and very large corporations that are the ones that are the beneficiaries of building these plants. And as a result, they have the money to actually put out information and make it look as though things are improving. But really, you know, there's AACL has never sold a reactor outside of Canada that wasn't to a totalitarian country. You know, we have a tremendous track record as international exporters of nuclear technology. We sold a reactor to Argentina when the generals were in charge. You know, at the same time we were selling them a reactor, they were taking people out in planes and dropping them into the Atlantic Ocean. We sold a reactor to Romania under Ceausescu, who was considered the worst of all the Soviet-era leaders in Eastern Europe. We've sold reactors to Korea when Korea was, in fact, being run by General Park as a dictator. We sold reactors to India and Pakistan, and they've now used those reactors and that technology to make bombs. We have a very dirty record in Canada on our exports of nuclear reactors, and our last sale was 10 years ago, and it went to China. And China is anything but a free society. So where are the sales? They're not happening anywhere where people have a free choice. And what's happening in Ontario is, again, what they've done in the past, which is try to railroad the public. Suddenly, we have to start building a reactor, or 10 years from now, we're going to not have enough power. It's just nonsense. They create the belief in, they try to create the belief in society that we have no other choice, that we have to go with this, and we have to go with it right now, because it, you know, it takes 10 years to build a reactor. And it's just not true. When you look at the Ontario Power Generation Report, which you referred to earlier in the call, clearly, they did not answer the questions the government gave them. And the Sierra Club responded to that report by saying, send it back to the OPA and tell them to do the job right. They did not do complete research on the on how effective conservation and efficiency programs could be in Ontario. I know personally the consultant who wrote the report, and he told them that they needed to give him more time and more resources to actually develop a full scenario on what was possible, because, in fact, because we dismembered Ontario Hydro in a failed attempt to turn over the industry to free enterprise a few years back, Ontario Hydro stopped gathering data on end use, so it's very difficult to tell exactly what's possible. But clearly, far more can be done in terms of in the short term on conservation and in putting regulations in place so that we don't grow our demand for electricity as rapidly as we're growing it now. And right now, it's only growing at about 1%. We're not talking about huge changes here. We just have to stop it growing, and we can do that. A goal across Canada, by the way, and whether it's about nuclear power or dams or fossil plants, we have the technology and the knowledge to stop growing our demand for electricity and start shrinking it. And if we wanted to, in the next 30 years, we could reduce our demand for electricity across Canada to what we already are producing from hydro plants that are already there and already caused the damage that they're going to cause. And that should be our goal. Our goal should not be to build new technology. It should be to reduce the demand for electricity, and we can do it. And there's every product that comes out now, it uses less power than the product we bought last year. And with a few regulations and a few incentives, we could change things rapidly. We could get this new technology in place much more rapidly than the normal turnover. And that's what we should be investing in. It's actually cheaper to reduce the demand for electricity than it is to provide greater supply.
Well, many thanks for your thoughts and your knowledge on this question this morning. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye, John. Bye-bye. I've been speaking with John Bennett. He is Senior Policy Advisor on Energy for the Sierra Club of Canada. And you can get more information on nuclear energy at www.sierraclub.ca. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
And now for this report from the Union of Concerned Scientists on Global Warming in New Hampshire, read by Steve Capron.
The following comes from a special Global Warming in New Hampshire study and analysis by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Climate trends. In New England, everyone jokes about the fickle weather. Although there is some natural variation in the weather every year, over longer time periods, we see climate trends emerge. If you grew up in New Hampshire, you probably remember winters being longer and snowier. In the Northeast United States, the average annual temperature has increased by almost 2 degrees over the last century. Even more striking, New England's average winter temperature has increased over 4 degrees over the last 30 years. These temperature changes are affecting the region's plants, animals, and environment. For example, the average snow cover season has decreased by more than 15 days compared with 30 years ago. And the New Hampshire state flower, the purple lilac, now blooms 4 days earlier. Much of this warming is caused by emissions, primarily carbon dioxide, that blanket the earth and trap heat. The main source of excess carbon dioxide is the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas to generate electricity and drive our cars. If we continue to generate large quantities of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases, we can expect an average temperature increase for the northeastern United States of between 5 and 9 degrees by 2100.